Coming up, Marg Helgenberger joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. Hi, Dennis. Hello, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
We're getting silly. Getting silly here in the I almost said in the office because I'm wearing a blazer.
Because you're wearing a blazer,
yeah.
Of course.
I'm such an actor. I'm like, I've got my blazer on. I never, you know, when I do a show, you know, well, the kind of movies I do where they make you bring your own clothes always.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Go, don't you have a blazer? I'm like, yeah, it's Armani Black Label, but from 1994. So I don't have any. I'm not a blazer.
No, me neither.
Yeah?
I have one that I usually wear with like t-shirts or tank tops or something if you have to class it up.
I did a movie called Picture Perfect. We're going to get to our topic. I always like to go the other way. But I did a movie called Picture Perfect with the lovely Jennifer Aniston and Kevin Pollak. And we shot for a week, and I had these amazing clothes, and she had these amazing clothes. She's got just an amazing body. She'd be incredible. Okay, so we shoot for a week. After a week, they come to me and they go, "We're going to have to change your wardrobe. You're upstaging like Jennifer." And they put me in one outfit was so bad, I called it the hoedown outfit. It was a red checkered. I mean, I look like, you know, Nanette Febre and Bandwagon. Get the Louisiana Sun. Get we all. Yeah, it was. I was in tears, and this was one of the jackets
that they took you out of.
Yeah, that they had me wear. So you can see how sexy it is. Everything
right.
had to be
yeah,
like
it comes all the way up to your
everything was
neck.
On here. And they in one scene, Glenn, I begged him at least. I said, "Can I wear a hat? Can I be like, you know, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis?" And yeah. So I did get to wear a hat, and I wore some little fun scarves and stuff. But literally every scene, if you see the movie, you're like, "Why is she in a power suit?" In every and Jennifer is in like, you know, Versace, incredibly short dresses. So,
well, isn't it just kind of sort of a little bit of a backhanded compliment? You looked too
no.
good.
No, it's
Come
not.
Come on.
It's not.
Bright side, Ileana.
It's not. It's not. Glenn Gordon Caron, who I adore, but said to me after a week, he goes, "You know, we saw you in To Die For, and, you know, we thought you were unattractive, and you're coming across now as too attractive. So stop it.
You're too damn attractive."
But you have to see the movie because you're like, why is she buttoned? Is she, did she?
Well,
did
definitely she, now watch it she, with that in mind.
Is she Amish? Like, why is she? Because you see in the movie, like,
oh,
I'm wearing shirts up to here, scarves. It's hysterical. Anyway.
That is hysterical.
Picture
I love
perfect.
It. I
now,
love it.
There should be a reboot, right? Me and Jennifer. Yep. Whatever happened to her.
Whatever happened.
Let's talk about, okay, this is Marg Helgenberger got her start being on Ryan's Hope, a soap opera.
Yeah.
Okay, this as two things have eluded me in my career. Number one is soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, a television commercial.
You've never done a commercial.
I did a commercial, but I was fired from it. I was fired from it.
So there's one no one has ever seen.
That was way back in the, you know, I was, you know, back when I was in acting school. I was
in New York.
Yeah, I got cast in a Trident Gum.
Oh, yes.
Trident Gum. And they gave three lines. There was
too sexy again?
Yeah.
No.
Too attractive.
This was because I couldn't say it really lasts. Get it? It was like somebody blows a bubble, and then somebody would say, "It's pink," you know, and the guy handed out the lines, and my line was, "It really lasts." So
what happened probably is that they fired you, and then they fired the writers, and then wrote a different
line. No. They had three people, and, you know, the first girl was like, "It's juicy, it's pink, it really lasts." They're like, what's the, come on up. And I'm like, it really lasts. No, bring it down. And eventually they fired me and got, they pulled someone else from there. I had to sit in the crowd humiliated while somebody else had my line.
Did you ever go on an audition for a soap?
Yes.
A daytime drama.
I did. And again, all my friends at the Neighborhood Playhouse, like Allison Janney, tons of people got, not that I was, my roommate, I mean, let's get our biography of Ileana Douglas straight, shall we?
Okay, yes, let's do it.
My roommate was Stephen Rogers, who I reference in the book quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It was because of Stephen. Stephen went to the Neighborhood Playhouse. He was in school with Allison Janney. I was not in school. I followed her. Mm-hmm. But they were, and he has written I, Tonya. I'm bringing this all together.
Oh, yeah.
With her. So they're lifelong friends. I'm sort of on the fringe. No, that's not true. But anyway, that's how I ended up at the Playhouse. But she and many people in there, Dylan McDermott, they'd all get these soap jobs. I could never get a soap job. And I remember getting some really, I finally like got some big audition for, you know, Guiding Light or whatever. Mm. And the casting person did this very weird thing. They said, do your whole audition to me. And then they said, I'm the camera. And then they went like this.
And if you're not, if you're just listening to this on iTunes, Ileana's got her hands on either side of her face. Like she's got blinders
like
on.
Like I'm a horse.
Like a horse with blinders.
In the Kentucky Derby. And the woman stayed like that. And I was like, is she going to put her hands down? No, she's not. So I sort of got the giggles and I did the scene. And then there was this long pause. I love critiques. I'm kidding. Oh,
yeah.
We know. The woman goes, you know what I liked about that? How much you enjoyed it. And needless to say, I did not get it. And
did
I never, and I did not get it. And I used to think it was like, and I always get that little sneering, like, you're too ethnic kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I don't know what that means. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't Americana enough to be on a soap opera.
Right.
So we'll get to the bottom of it with Marg. But yes, that eluded me to be on a soap opera because I just thought that would be really fun, you know? It would be, you know, all the great theater actors were on.
Absolutely.
Soap opera. Do they even have soap operas anymore?
They still do have a few of them.
Really? Which one? Do they have Ryan's Hope?
I don't think Ryan's Hope is on anymore. No. But like Days of Our Lives is still on.
Never saw it.
I think. That was the one I watched when I was in high school and college.
Again, get your Ileana Douglas biography straight. We only got one channel. So we only had one channel. We only got CBS. So I only can reference soap operas. There was The Guiding Light.
Yeah.
And there was As the World Turns.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what else.
Yeah. General Hospital.
That's
Days of Our Lives.
That's NBC. Oh, ABC.
The kids, as my friends used to call it, all my children.
That was big. My friends, yeah. I'd have to go over to my friend's house to watch, you know, to watch that. Again, like I watched the old fogey Guiding Light. None of the kids were into the Guiding Light. That was the boring one. But that is the one that got, you know, Meg Ryan was on that one.
Mm.
Kevin Bacon. Mm. Some other probably cool people that I can't think of.
Demi Moore was in soap operas as well.
Yeah. Oh, Alec Baldwin.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of people. I resent, you know, on my list of grievances.
which is sizable, let's
No
just
grudge
say.
Is too small, no, as John no. Milia says. I was never on a soap opera. And, you know, now I'd be offered one. I don't think I'd want to do one. It's too many lines.
It's hard work from what I understand. It's a bit of a grind.
Why are you laughing?
Too many lines.
She says the actress.
Yes, exactly.
God, don't keep me on camera so much, for God's sake.
I have to say these?
I know. Oh, gosh. Anyway, well, let's bring in Marg. Enough of my tragic career path. Marg, unlike me, began her career on Ryan's Hope. She was also in ER. Wonderful show, 30-something, with my neighbor, Melanie Mayron. And, of course, her breakout role is Casey in China Beach, won her an Emmy Award. She may be best known, but we're going to see. I don't know if you're best known for that, for CSI Crime Investigation, Under the Dome, and your films. Erin Brockovich, Fire Down Below, In Good Company, Bad Boys. God, there's so many movies we're going to talk about. Always Crooked Hearts. And you just finished doing a play, What We're Up Against, an off-Broadway. Please welcome Mark Helgenberger. Thank you so much for being here. And you're from
Thanks for having me.
You're from Nebraska.
I am, from a very small town, North Bend, Nebraska.
I did a film in Nebraska.
What did you do?
It was called Jesus. Don't do that to me.
Sorry. I know you can't do that to me either.
Darn it! I can't remember.
Do you remember where you shot?
It was actually about in Omaha. It was about the Columbine shooting. Oh. I can't think of the name of it. I apologize. But it was a series. So we shot in a small town. It was an indie film, and me and Tom Arnold were in it. And a lot of like local sort of kids. But man, did I fall head over heels for Omaha. I just thought it was the cool. You're looking shocked.
Well, a lot of people enjoy it. I mean, I
thought it was very artsy.
Yeah. I grew up in a town, a very small town called North Bend, which is about an hour outside of Omaha. Mm-hmm. So that's where, when we were teenagers, you know, you'd always go to Omaha or Lincoln because there was nothing to do in my hometown.
And, yeah.
But yeah, my mom and a lot of my family lives in Omaha now, so I get there once or twice a year.
Did you ever run into Alexander Payne?
I've never run into him in Omaha, although, you know, he lives there half the year.
Yeah, that's...
And he's asked, you know, he wants me to get involved in one of his, like, foundations or something.
But God, I would do it.
Yeah, so I sent him an email because I got his email address from his best friend, you know, his friend, and this woman, Ann Beater. Anyway.
Oh, yes, I did.
Yeah, so I don't know. It bounced back to me. So she either gave me the wrong one or maybe he changed it. I don't know. I have no idea. So,
were you aware, and I'm going to get to my number one question, but Marlon Brando, of course, from Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Does that interest you at all? The first thing I did was go. I love the internet. I found Marlon Brando's house. He is in Omaha. Two different houses. The first house was like, oh my God, this looks exactly like it was like a farmhouse, wonderful. The second house was tiny and like really in the bad, sort of a bad part of town. So it made me think, I wonder what happened to the family that they...
Well, did you read his autobiography?
I did.
Well, you know, there was all that trouble. You know, his mother, sadly was a hopeless alcoholic. And his father would like go on these, he'd like take off and... So his home life was not great.
Yeah.
He went to like a military academy outside of like in Illinois or someplace like that.
Yeah.
But his mother was an actress.
His
mother was at the Omaha, and his sister too.
Yeah. And had an acting, I think, school there, right?
Yeah. There was the Omaha Community Playhouse, which is where Henry Fonda got his start, and like Dorothy McGuire, like all of these, you know, famous movie stars and actors.
So it is an interesting thing. If you're looking for a place to travel, the only thing was that I was not the food. I know,
it's a lot of steak. If you stick with the steak, the beef, I mean, if you don't eat beef, then you're kind of out of luck.
But it was tough. I lived on like...
A lot of sauces, right? It's like a sauce or cheese on everything.
It was cheese on everything. A lot of iceberg lettuce.
Midwest.
I lived on... like little cans of tuna that opened. That's all I remember.
Yeah, although, speaking of Alexander Payne, there is a really good Greek restaurant in Omaha.
I seem to recall
that. I think
it's
called like Greek Isles or something like that. And it's, so some of the ethnic food
is good.
Is good, yes.
Yeah.
And if you want a good steak, but other than that, it's just, and lots of it. Plates.
Yes.
Plates like piled with potatoes and meat and and iceberg lettuce.
Lots of iceberg lettuce. But it was fun to travel there. I went to the area where you can put your foot on four states or something. Missouri and Iowa. And
oh, you did? I haven't even done that.
St. Louis. Yeah, whenever I go to a movie, it's mainly like, I get to
do all the...
I went to Missouri. I really like, I travel quite a bit when I'm doing the movie, like on a day off. I went to Jesse James' house in Missouri, or I went to...
Willa Cather. Did you go to Willa Cather's house?
I didn't. You should go back there.
And I've read a couple, and I did a
Boys Town. Went to Boys Town. Did you ever
Boys
go there?
Boys Town, right, yeah.
That's they have the world's largest ball of stamps, if you're interested.
I didn't know that.
They do. It's gigantic. I love it. Somewhere along the way, communities came up with, like...
attractions.
Like world's largest... You know, like in Louisville, they have the Louisville Slugger. They have this gigantic bat.
Yeah, but they also have in Louisville, they also have those whiskey, those converted whiskey factories and that have all become kind of cool and chic. And out the Ali Museum.
Yes. I love. What do you like to travel? I love traveling. I mean, for film, I
yes.
love it.
Yes. Oh, I mean, because it takes you to places that you, you probably would have never gone to Omaha if you had you not.
Not in
that
a million
film.
Years. And like I said, I was thrilled to go there and really have fun and really be there for quite a long time.
Yes.
So that I could really, you know, travel around and stuff and see all the sights. As I said, this is my favorite thing. Like, why are you at Boys Town? But I love stuff like that. Okay, my favorite question, of course, what is the first film you saw and who took you to see it?
You know, there was a lot of films that I saw when I was a kid, but you know, in this town I grew up, there wasn't a movie theater. So mm-hmm. it was not like people didn't go to the movies. And if you did, you went to like the drive-in.
Right.
And so there was a lot of films that, you know, I saw with like my aunt who was about 11 years older than me. So when I was five, you know, she was 16. And like, mm-hmm. who doesn't want to hang out with like 16, mm-hmm. 15 and 16, 17 year olds?
Yeah.
Especially if they take you to the drive-in.
Yeah.
And she would be saddled with, you know, me and my sister and brother. Somehow she put up with, I don't know, I guess because the other kids like did the same thing. But that was, you know, and it was all those like goofy, like beach movies, you know, like with Annette Funicello and some Elvis movies, you know. Mm-hmm. But the movie I think that probably like stood out to me when I got a little older, like 12 or mm-hmm. so, was The Godfather. And I saw it in a drive-in with mm-hmm. my family. I was visiting my family in California, my first time out of Nebraska, visiting my kids. And my Aunt Betty, she was a tough old broad, and she smoked like a fiend, and she had a grand, she was like a bigot, and she was just tough. And she thought it would be okay to take her 12-year-old niece from Nebraska to The Godfather. And then the all night long, I had nightmares about the horse head.
Of course.
The horse's head in the bed, and the extraordinary violence in that movie.
Yeah.
But the movie that I think probably like opened my eyes to acting and the craft of acting and just how beautiful it could be was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Because mm-hmm. I guess it was probably about maybe 16 or something when I saw that film. And I kind of got coerced into being involved in the speech department. And my English teacher, she was starting this speech and drama like thing. And I had there was a session called Interpretation of Drama. And you'd take things out of books. And I chose One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest because of seeing that film.
Yeah.
And I did a bunch of the characters, right? You do the voices. Yeah. And you look here. And then you look here for the eyeline. And I've since become friends with Jack Nicholson. Name dropping here. Sorry.
No, but, I love it.
We love name dropping.
And I told him that story. And of course, he loved it.
See,
you know?
Everything's cyclical in a movie at all. I really believe in these things. It's like they had. That's why I always start by asking people what first movies, because there always seems to be some
odd connection
where it ends up. And how did you become friends?
I could have never. A man that I went out with for quite a few years was very good friends with Jack. Still mm-hmm. is. And so, you know, I would always go up there for Thanksgiving and his birthday and Christmases sometime.
Did you
Super
ever
Bowls
steal anything?
And,
no, I'm kidding. Did you take things?
No, I would.
That's amazing.
The first time I went up there, I just was like, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe it. You know?
Yeah.
And looking at the Oscars all, you know. They're just all kind of like smashed together.
As Hollywood royalty narrows, you know.
I know.
It was like Elizabeth Taylor, and then now we're literally down to which I hate to
a handful.
Say it. It's like you've got Nicholson, Warren Beatty,
who I see up there all the time too.
And yeah,
I mean, going to like especially like his.
How
80th.
Do I get in? No.
I'm surprised you don't know him. You seem to, you know.
I knew Warren Beatty, actually. Well, we're going to get to this through Gary Shandling, I met Warren.
Okay.
But I have never...
Oh, yeah, they were friends.
And as I write in my book, which I'm going to give you my book, I got an invite to Marlon Brando's house, but I declined because I was afraid. And I talk about it's my biggest... Well, because I would have had sex with him. It was my biggest show business regret. I'm pretty sure... Well, I don't know for sure, but he invited me to lunch at his house. Uh-huh. And sent me like a bushel full of flowers. Is that like a hint?
Yeah, he certainly is interested for sure. I'm surprised because was he usually likes women, Asian women, or
what can I say?
Polynesian women.
He called me a tuning fork. He told me that. That's what he said that night too. But
a tuning fork.
I'm a tuning fork. Yeah, Marlon Brando says so.
What do you
so.
Think he meant?
Oh,
by
I know
that.
What he meant completely. It was a vibrating. I met him, and it's a very long story, which you'll read about. But we just were on the same wavelength, and I was very emotional, and he got very emotional. He started to cry, and he said, "My God, you're a tuning fork." Now I'm crying, and we were just radiating on this emotional line back and forth.
Oh my God.
I met him and I immediately went into, I don't know if what your acting background was, but my teacher was Sanford Meisner.
Yeah, I studied Meisner, not with him, but.
Well, even though I went to school in the 80s, it was like, it felt like it was 1955, you know. I mean, the methods of teaching were very old school. You know, and very
serious. Was that at the Neighborhood Playhouse?
That was at the Neighborhood Playhouse, okay. Yes. So everything I did in my life was like, being truthful, reality, like don't deny, you know. So when I met Brando, it was a galvanizing moment for me because it was everything, you know, that I'd studied. So,
and did you talk about the Actors Studio with him?
Or yes, we did.
Sometimes he in his autobiography, or if you've seen any like that Larry King interview he did, you know, towards the end of his life, I guess it was. He so kind of like had a disdain for acting, you know, and I don't know how much of that was just him saying it, or if he. But I think he really did still love the craft of it.
Yeah,
just,
I think it's like everybody. It's hard, you know, when you're. You know, when somebody like that and the fame, and I think there was a purity that he did love it. And then, you know, it's so complicated. And then people that you know die, and James Dean and Montgomery Clift, and then maybe you have no one to talk to about it. Marilyn Monroe, you know. That's what I always think. Mm-hmm. I think that if you approach it in the right way, that of course they want to talk about it, and they're artists and they're interesting, but they don't want you to think that that's all they are, I guess. They perceive that you're just interested in the fame part of it, maybe, and not necessarily the Actor's Studio part and the method. Anyway, he mentioned, he clarified for me that really Stella Adler was his...
Right. I remember reading that in the book.
Yeah, was more his thing than Lee Strasberg. He actually blamed Lee Strasberg for destroying Marilyn Monroe. He thought she was a natural comedian, and he thought that Lee Strasberg like ruined her. You know,
she was a natural comedian.
She
can't take your eyes off her. She was just so.
All right, let's get back to this party at Jack Nicholson's house, which I'm.
Well, you know, I once in a while when I feel like the moment's right, because he's sometimes he can. And I'm not the only one who has said this. Sometimes, you know, it's hard to follow what he's saying, you know?
Uh-huh.
And
is that because of colorful substances?
Sometimes, I guess. Yeah. But anyway, when I feel like, I think I can probably ask him. He loves talking. One time he got so animated talking about these old, like, Roger Corman films.
Yeah.
And I just would sit there and just, like, listen. He would, like, giggle and, you know, howl. And these things going way back, you know, before he was famous, you know. And but then one time I asked him about The Shining, and I asked about Kubrick and, you know, the amount of takes that he's notoriously known to have people, you know, go through, and sometimes like really arduous situations, and poor Shelley Duvall supposedly, just like how many times she was tormented. Yeah. And he said, well, you know, the thing is about Stanley, well, he knows when he's got it. So, you know, then it's kind of freeing for an actor. You just kind of like, just keep doing it, because that's what we're here for, right? We just get to get him act. But he says, but you know, Stanley also owned all of his all of that equipment. So it, and he rented it out to the studio. So every take he was making more and more. Every day that went by, he made more and more money. That a lot of people didn't know about, you know. I mean, if who wouldn't do that if you owned all the equipment? You, of course, you can. Nobody's going to say no to Stanley Kubrick. So
wow, yeah, I can't. Well, that's I got to somehow get. I'm so distracted. I've got to somehow get into them. No, I would only see him when I knew Dennis Hopper.
Right,
Dennis Hopper had parties at his house, and that's
I never
time.
Had a chance to meet him, but
he was incredible. And but I was always a little intimidated by Jack Nicholson. I never would he go up to him and say like hi, or just
well,
wouldn't
he's
want
an
to scare him, or
you know,
something.
He's an intimidating guy. Yeah. I mean, you know, but when you know he's approachable, he definitely is approachable.
Yeah. If I see
if he's
him
in
around,
a good, you know, sometimes he's. In a bit of a funk or something, you know.
Yeah.
You can tell, you know, when I got, I've gone up there and whether. But I, I've had a lot of, you know, I've had a lot of fun up there, and his I've met a lot of you know, his family members, and his mm-hmm. his kids are really sweet and nice people. And
you have you ever reenacted the Cuckoo's Nest
playing Nurse Ratched and McMurphy?
I say this all the time. I still think that is one of the most terrifying scenes. In it's so disturbing that scene, you know, with
the final scene, or when he won't take the medicine
and he
strangles her.
Yeah, it's so upsetting.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm getting chills thinking about it. It is.
It's so,
so
real.
Oh my God. Yeah, I know. That's what was so astonishing when I saw that movie as a teenager. It just like this. This doesn't seem like acting. This is just like,
yeah.
Who are these
people? It's like a documentary.
Yes, that's what it seemed like. And he was just so amazing in it. Remember, he was playing basketball when he just was so loose and improvisational and just extraordinary. Such an amazing actor.
Yeah, that's a great film. I interviewed the editor of that film. The only thing I know about is they did shoot it in order, and
oh, they did,
and she didn't. She was not cutting the scenes like until he shot the movie and then gave it to her. So he didn't. So she had to look at it as a whole. And I often wondered if that had something interesting. Wow. So she wasn't cutting scenes as they went. He shot the entire scene as much as possible in order. And then gave it to her. And they began on day one with the footage. So, yeah, it's fascinating.
Kind of made her job easy, I guess. Easier.
Yeah, to do, well, he wanted to be there and, you know, so I don't know.
Who was the editor?
Her name is Lindsay Klingman. She was nominated for an Academy Award. I don't know who won that year. Was that Rocky? Maybe. Which one for best editing?
I don't know. Actually.
I'm going to take a guess and say Rocky, and probably I'm wrong lately. Okay, I want to go. Aside from that, were the films that you watched growing up? Did you always, you know, want to go?
No,
into?
To be an actor because of them. No, because you know when you grow up in a little town like that, you know, you go into a profession that's pretty practical and solid. So mm-hmm. I thought I would be going to follow my mother's footsteps, become a nurse. Mm-hmm. So even throughout high school, even though I got involved in like. The speech and drama program. I was still taking all the, you know, requisite science courses and stuff like that. And then midway, I know what it was. I was checking out schools to go to, nursing schools, and it was a 4-year nursing school program, whatever, in Yankton, South Dakota. It was an all girls Catholic school, and we went, of course, like in February when it's just bleak as hell. And I don't know. Something hit me, and I said, I can't. I can't do, you know, I've lived this for 18 years or whatever. I can't do it for another 4 or more, you know? So I, you know, told my parents, I said, I'm sorry, I can't do this. Well, what are you going to do? Let me go to a state college, which is now part of the University of Nebraska system. It's called Kearney State College. Mm-hmm. And I just was a liberal arts major and just started doing a bunch of plays. And then I transferred to Northwestern, where I graduated. So at Northwestern, you know, things really picked up because, you know, I was surrounded by young people who were, you know, they had no qualms. No, I'm going to be an actor. No, I'm going to be a director. No, I'm going to be. And a lot of them did become go on to, you know, great success. Julie Louis-Dreyfus being one of them. She was in, we were in Three Penny Opera together, actually, there.
Oh.
And so, but yeah, I would have to say, yeah, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that one. And a lot of those movies in the 70s, you know, I still am Diane Keaton fan.
Yeah.
And I see her up at Jack's, you know, often. And she's such a delight.
No, I'm kidding.
She's such a delight.
Oh, my God, Diane Keaton.
With her press-on nails and...
her big belts.
And her... yes, I mean, literally, she had on this... Last time I saw her up there, she had on... plaid, what I thought was like gel or whatever. No, it was those Sally Hansen press-on nails. Oh, yeah, that's... And she drinks her red wine with ice in it. Oh, no, I love it like that. You know, I don't like it just... she's wow. so quirky. But she's a... she's anyway, so I, like, went... of course, Annie Hall and Looking for Mr. Goodbar. And, you know, she was... She was so incredible in all those films.
Unmarried Women was my mom took me to see. That's how we explain divorce in my house. My mom took me to see Unmarried Women. I was like, no, that's why I said that's
why we're the parents divorced.
My parents are divorced. Everything in my life was a movie, or we used a movie to, you know, to brace if we got in a fight. Our way of talking was like. What's the name of that actor that's in the movie? You know, that was always get back in. So yeah, movies are so much part of my language. Anyway, so I said in the beginning, although I auditioned for a soap opera, I never got in. I never even got on a soap opera, and you were
their loss.
I know. Well, I thought I was too quirky or something. If I would audition, like the small parts, like the 5-line parts, were always like the Irish maid, you know. So I don't think they had like an funny Italian, you know. The maid always, are, you know, with those, you know what I mean? Those five lines.
When I was, because that was my first job, was this soap opera, Ryan's Hope, and it was when soaps were like really popular, in the 80s, and
huge,
especially the ABC ones. So when I did Ryan's Hope was ABC, and then there was One Life, all my kids, we called it All My Children, and One Life to Live. But on All My it was either All My Children. Yeah, I think it was All My Children. There was a woman on there that was like became a huge star. Not Susan Lucci. Uh-huh. It was a woman, but she was super quirky. What the hell was her name? She was like, she was like talk like this, and she was, you know, quirky like in that regard. And I remember that being like, whoa, she was.
Well, maybe once you were on, or I just sucked at auditioning. It could have been that.
Yeah,
was it ever like Tootsie? Did you ever have to shoot a go live? Is that complete fiction? Like that whole, remember in Tootsie
that's right.
Where something happens and they've got to do the whole show live. Is that?
It didn't happen. No, but we shared a studio with the Tom, with this show called Loving. There was a soap opera called Loving.
Yeah.
And that happened on that show. And
really?
I don't know if they said that something happened with the tape or whatever. And so, of course, we're all like glued to the television just to see if somebody was going to fuck up or, you know. But yeah, that's the only time I remember, but not on our show. Never happened.
What about the technique, which seems almost impossible, of holding at the end of the scene?
Yeah.
So,
awful.
For people that don't know, that was the classic moment, right? Where the camera sort of, does it zoom in on you or does it hold? Does it move in a little bit?
Sometimes it would zoom in, yes. But
so you end the scene in a big, and you say, I am your daughter or something.
Yeah.
How do you not laugh when you do? I mean, I guess you get fired.
Because it would just be several seconds, you know?
Yeah.
And how do you maintain that without having egg in your face? And
how do you do that?
You know, I wish I had an easy answer for that other than...
Just try to stay in the moment.
You just try to stay in the moment. And... You know, there was a man that I worked with who we ended up like marrying each other on the show, and his character's name was Max Dubujak.
Of course it was.
And this actor, he just never knew his fucking lines, and he was always looking at the teleprompter, and it just was so annoying. And you know, if I occasionally I would glance at the teleprompter, but I hated it because I found it much more distracting.
And, oh yeah.
So you're looking at somebody and you're trying to be in the moment and be in, and here's this guy's like glancing over at the teleprompter to make sure he doesn't have another line. I don't think he ever knew what the scene was about ever, you know? Anyway, so yeah, soaps, they're tough. They were tough, you know.
Tons of lines.
Yeah, but I got to the point where I would like time myself to see how little time it took me to memorize the entire script. Usually I could do it over my lunch hour, which I don't know how well I actually – it was like cramming for exam. As soon as you shot it, it was like out your brain.
Yeah.
You know, you never really remembered any of it.
What about people – may I ask what part of New York you lived in when you were
– I lived mostly on the Upper West Side.
Oh, I love that. That's where I lived. 69th Street and then big move to 70th.
69th and
45 West 69th for those who would like to go visit it. 45 West. No, my name is actually still on the mailbox, believe it or not. It's still there. Isn't that crazy?
How did that happen?
Me and Stephen Rogers, who was my roommate, we, you know, it was like one of these places that had your name in the little slot, you know?
Yeah.
And it would always fall out. And so one day out of frustration, I was like, okay, this is crazy. I'm just going to write. So I wrote Douglas Rogers on the metal part of the mailbox.
Like in a Sharpie or something?
Yes.
Okay.
Marg, it is still... It's like After Hours or something, you know, or Martin Scorsese. It is still there. Like, no one is... It's the building.
I think we should get one of our New York friends to go and take a picture of that.
No, Steven was just there. He goes, oh, my God, it is still here.
But I want to see it.
It's like, we can't believe, like, nobody bothered to wash it off, you know. It's still there. So, yes, I lived on the West Side. Did you frequent, you know, the go-to places like Cafe Central, or did you hang out with other actors?
A couple of times. I can't say I was hung out at Cafe Central, but I definitely went there a few times. I was trying to think of the name of the bar that was on 72nd Street.
Kappa Keg?
No. It was supposedly where the film Looking for Mr. Goodbar, like that's where that...
Okay.
You know, where she was hooking up with guys and that, in that particular bad guy.
I think I know which bar you mean, but I can't think of it. Did you go downstairs?
Yes. But like a few steps, not like into a, you know, lower level.
That's I know which one you mean, but
it was like very popular place.
Very, very popular. Yeah, when I got to New York, which was 82, I think.
That's when I got there.
Yeah. I mean, I was in school, but we would, you know, we would find places that had happy hour. And we'd, like, it was so pathetic. Like, literally go get one drink, be there all night. And, you know, if they had, like... You know, they'd have food
snacks.
In those days they'd actually be
we would do that too.
Shoveling in.
Were you at NYU?
No, I was at the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Oh, right.
The Neighborhood Playhouse.
Oh, that's right, because it was like a full-time thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was full-time. So we went, you know, we had all of our bars that, you know, that we would frequent. And they were all pretty much on the over West Side. And then sometimes, again, we were so hungry. Columbus Avenue is where all the restaurants were. And we'd see actors all the time. So we were always like that. That sort of kept our spirits up. We're like, if we saw Kevin Kline, for instance, we'd be like walking on air for 2 days. Like, someday.
I remember when I was waiting at a bus stop and Al Pacino. He was walking towards me, and I thought it was like the boyfriend of a girlfriend of mine.
Yeah.
And then he got closer, and I went, oh, my God. And that was, you know, those were the days.
Yeah.
He was like, whatever. He was probably, I don't know, late 30s or something, whatever he was. And he was like one of my early crushes when I was a kid. I think
everybody.
From probably seeing him in The Godfather, as violent and as, you know. Because, you know, when all my friends were like into like, David Cassidy or Sean Cassidy even. I was like, no, Al Pacino is...
He's the guy. He's the man.
Yeah.
So now, how did you get from New York to L.A. to be in China Beach? And what year was... Because I don't remember.
86.
86, okay.
Yes. Well, I did a pilot that ended up going for like six episodes. It was a very short-lived series called Shell Game that co-starred... Margot Kidder.
Wow.
Yeah, it was for CBS. And that brought me to Los Angeles. And then when I was shooting the six episodes, not the pilot itself, I reconnected with this actor who who had played a role on the soap. Because on the soap, I was a cop on the soap. And I went undercover to break up this prostitution ring. And I went undercover as a prostitute. My pseudonym was Pepper Adams, and I moved into a Times
that
Square.
That is very subtle.
Right? A Times Square, like, sleazy, whatever, hotel, and it was run by this guy, Marv Unser. Well, his character's name was Marv Unser, and that was my husband. Yeah. He ended up becoming my husband, Alan Rosenberg. And, that whole time, I met a lot of people then. This actor who we're still friends, well, especially Alan's still friends with, because Vito Reginas, I don't know if you know who he is, but his character's name was, I don't know why I remember all this, Ace Landrace, which is an amazing character name, right?
It's great. Yeah. It sounds like a Jim Carrey movie.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Ace Landrace.
So that, when I reconnected with Alan, yeah. And then we, like, hit it off, and, you know, that kept me in L.A.
Uh-huh. And you on China Beach.
He was in The Last Temptation of Christ, because I think you're in that too, right?
I'm the voice. That's the movie was made. I actually haven't seen the movie that many times. I was working for Peggy Siegel, and they were dubbing the movie, and they were rushing it out because there was all this controversy,
right?
And they needed to dub.
Heard a story about that too.
Yeah, so they needed to dub. Oh, I want to hear it. They had to dub all these parts, and I had put on my resume because I once did a play where I was murdered. I was like, was just tap dancing in show business. But on the thinnest of things under special skills, because I had no credits, I put blood-curdling screams. Yeah. And Martin Scorsese's assistant, like, I'm working. She goes, do you really have a blood-curdling scream? I was like, yeah, it's horrible. I'm okay, go down at 5 o'clock, and you're going to scream for Martin Scorsese. And I did, and it led
little
to
did
a,
you know.
It led to a 10-year relationship. But no, I dubbed all these parts. But again, in those days, people don't remember this. It was like a black and white dupe of the film. Like, you were looking at a dupe of black and white. So I don't remember much of the film, and I'm all over it. I did crowd noises and screams and stuff, but I know that Alan, when I was doing research, he looks incredibly familiar, so it must be from that
yeah
movie.
He was one of the disciples. He was a doubting Thomas. Yeah.
Well, it's not easy to get in a Marty movie, so he must have passed muster.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was one of those things that it he was cast in it, and then it was like it was put on hold for a few years, because I guess because of the the controversy surrounding the subject matter and so on. And then it like got rebooted pretty quickly. And
yeah.
I know that they shot in Morocco, and I was supposed to go visit him, I remember. And then I got cast in China Beach. And so we shot the pilot of China Beach, so I never got to go to Morocco. Still haven't been to Morocco.
Oh, you should go. It's beautiful. I was there in Ouarzazate. Which is a nice, and you can take a camel ride and go into the desert and spend the night in the desert. I thought it was kind of romantic. It was kind of fun. The food, not crazy about the food. Pigeon is what is served pretty much three times a day. And it's not one of those things like there's
wow,
other.
Really?
It's like, yeah, you have a choice. You can have goat or pigeon. And so I often opted for the pigeon. If there's someone out there and they can tell me what else there was, because we were at the best places, and even at the best places, it was like, oh my God, it's pigeon again. Pigeon's a big deal there.
Well, I know he got really violently ill there, probably from the food. And,
yeah.
I knew he had to go to a doctor, and then also they had permed his hair, and the solution like fried his forehead, and they used to joke with him because he had like this huge birth. Well, it looked like a Gorbachev. You know, Gorbachev had that big pink, birthmark. Anyway, I don't know why I got off on that. But other than that, he had a great experience, because like all those guys that were the disciples, they would smoke hash all night and play music, because there's a lot of musicians. And
yeah.
Besides David Bowie, this guy Michael Bean, who had been this band The Call, and they had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a nice.
And everybody's like, most actors can carry a tune of some kind and play a few songs on the guitar.
Well, again, that's when movies were fun and people would hang out and they'd have months and, you know, although I don't think Marty had a very good time on the film. For what, just personally, he was going through some, you know, I think the film was very hard. It was very low budget. So I believe that those were, he had some struggles with that. But I know the actors because he loves actors, of course, working with the actors. But I think some of the production stuff was tough on him from my recollection. When you're doing China Beach, I only got to play a prostitute once in my life. I was like, it's the ultimate compliment. Like, I'm going to play a hooker with a heart of gold. It's such a popular trope. So when you were cast as a prostitute, did you, you know... What did you try to bring, and I'm not even being facetious, like not a real prostitute, but how do you make a part like that not a cliche?
Well, you know, when they told me, because a lot of those characters, and certainly many of the stories, the stories that became episodes, they were all based on, you know, stories that had been shared with them by vets. I mean, that's one thing that was really, that show was an amazing experience, actually, all around.
It's a great show.
The beginning of each season, we would spend a whole weekend, like, cooped up in John Sigurd Young, who was a co-creator of the show, like, in his office at Warner Brothers, the cast and, you know, like, department heads and a bunch of vets, men and women, and just, like, hearing their stories. It was, like, a huge, like, sob fest, and we would always, like, you know, come back to that weekend, you know, every time we'd go to forward. There was a lot, very emotional, like heartfelt show. And, but that, my character was kind of like a compilation of a few people. And it was this guy, Bill Broyles, who co-created the show, who had served in Nam as a Marine. He remembers seeing a woman, an attractive young woman, like at an air base or something. And he always said, like, what's her story? And they sort of found out that she had kind of like these papers that she was like a civilian secretary, but it was very, you know, sketchy. But the thing about the character I played, which was named Casey from Casey, you know, she was really like kind of the first kind of yuppie or something. She was a real entrepreneur. I mean, she was always, even though she was selling herself to the upper echelon, not to any of the grunts, but she would do other things. She would have all this black market materials that she was dealing with. She started like a beauty salon on the base and like sold cars to all the GIs. Like, she was always, you know, scheming, and that's why I focused on the most.
Yeah,
like, she was, you know, smart and tough and, you know, direct. And she also didn't, like, even though it kind of came out later, she didn't like get sucked into the whole, like, you know, what, you know, how the heartfelt stories that all these young guys, these GIs would lay on the nurses. You know, I just kind of like would take a step back and
It's always interesting to me that they write prostitute men, write these prostitute characters. They're so multidimensional. You know, they've got like interesting outlooks and stories and backgrounds. I don't know. I wonder what a prostitute represents. I mean, going all the way back to of human bondage, you know, it's just always an interesting trope, I find, in films. Representing almost more than a prostitute, representing, I don't know, some moral dilemma. You can just do a lot with it, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I...
You know. Yeah, and I recently read this play, The Balcony, you know, that Genet play, The Balcony, because this one, producers wanted me to read it, perhaps maybe develop it, you know, as a, you know, something to New York. But it's, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but that's all set in like an S&M parlor. It's set during a war. It doesn't really say specifically which war, but and there's all this like role playing with like a bishop and then a general and a, you know, police chief and she's like that's where they all come for you know some sort of release, some sort of balance, and that's the one place that withstands against, you know, the siege, you know. And she, that character was like vastly interesting. I mean, they all seem to like grab. I guess because there's a part of them that is somewhat detached or something, and they can sort of, but yet they can take it all in.
I just feel like you can say something about society. You can say a lot with a character aside from just it being a gender, you know, female role. I don't know. That's just my own theory. Just because there's so many made, there's so many movies with, you know, with prostitutes in them.
I know.
For yeah. For actresses. Actually, yeah. There hasn't been one in a while. There was like a kind of a steady run, but I don't know if there has been one in the Okay, let's get to some of the we have to get to CSI, of course. Had you seen To Live and Die in L.A., which is one of my with Bill Peterson? It's a
yes, I think I had seen it when it came out, and but I so did I, you I know saw it again. Oh, no, I knew who he was, of course.
Oh, you knew.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know. When I saw To Live and Die, I was like...
Oh, no, not then. I didn't know who he was at the time. That was like his first film, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he had that like banner year. He did that, and he did Michael Mann movie, Manhunter.
Yes.
Yeah, I think he did those kind of back-to-back. And,
yeah.
And, you know, being this Chicago actor and both... Friedkin and Michael Mann, Chicago guys. I think they all like they were like this, you know, cabal or whatever. They just really and tough guys, you know, tough. So, but I had never worked with them. But it was like he's one of those actors that a lot of people said, "Oh, I think you two would to work well together. You two would like have chemistry." And then you know, lo and behold, it was this thing we ended up like doing. God knows how many episodes together. He was on it 9 seasons, I think.
Who are you talking about?
Bill Peterson.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Sorry, was I mumbling?
No, you. I just. Oh. Didn't
well, I don't think we ever
his
said his name. Actually,
no, you just went into that.
But,
so,
but
yeah,
we both. I knew, obviously.
But it was playing in my head. Can't you read? Can't you
Not
see it
yet?
Did you like mystery shows at all? Like, were you into that? Like the idea of being a, you know, forensics and all of that science, which is now speaking of tropes. Every Dateline. I mean, it's not like CSI. Like, that's every episode on Dateline.
Yeah.
They explain that it is not, that it takes years to find something. But
yes.
Were you,
not 48 minutes.
Yeah. Did you have that kind of interest? I mean, you were going to potentially be a nurse.
Right. You know, I can't say that I wasn't a huge fan of the genre. But when I was a kid, you know, the television shows that I gravitated, besides the variety shows, you know, like Carol Burnett and Sonny and Cher, those types of shows. I did really like Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess who didn't? It was just so fun. And I mean, I guess that's, I don't know, it's sort of a mystery show, right? It was you know, a lot of spy gadgetry and whatever. But, you know, and I used to think that CSI in its early days was, I used to equate it with Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know. I mean, but, you know, there was a show called The New Detectives that Anthony Zeiger, who created CSI, so he kind of loosely based CSI on that show. And it was all about the forensic, you know, the criminalists.
Yeah.
And how they solve, and you could get... easily get sucked into that show, and a lot of it was like, you know, they have that narrator with the way he talks like this, and like and they have these reenactments, and it was it's one of those shows that you kind of know if a show's like got legs, and when you read it and then when you see it put together, the pilot put together, and I always felt that the hardest hurdle was getting on the air, the toughest hurdle, because I just knew there was something about this show that was going to take off, and then it like kind of created this whole new genre.
Oh my God, it's the CSI on the moon. Every you know there was
and all these other shows that you
that
know,
followed were, the that, it almost invented the term procedural.
Right, I know.
It almost became you know, a phrase. I mean, but it went from, you know, it started with that. And your relationship on the show, how do you maintain, like, again, year in and year out? I would find that hard. You know, you get in the morning and you're in the makeup room and then you have to go to the set. I did some Law and Orders and I found it to be slightly tough. I'm like, God, is this... I gotta walk in that police. But I'm lazy. But that's me. But, you know, again, when you're doing the, you know, the bodies and the procedural things.
Well, I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, sometimes it was a challenge, you know. You didn't feel, I mean, and like everything, you know, some episodes are better than others. And,
right.
And I think the first 7 seasons of CSI were really solid because we had such great writers and good directors. And it was just, you know, it was still kind of an innovative show. And then, you know, when it just, like everything, it just kind of started, you know, there was a, I don't know, a lot of writers left and mm-hmm. some of those director producers left. And, you know, you're trying to rebuild and then Billy right. Peterson leaves. But you know, like I left on my own midway mm-hmm. through season 12 because I was burned out. I just, you know, like I was with some friends last night and people were talking about this article that Ellen Pompeo like yes. penned for the Hollywood Reporter mm-hmm. and which I was sort of surprised she's making more than Mariska actually because you know Mariska's has been doing it longer
yeah
and is SVU you know
yes.
I mean? But I guess she's whatever gray, right? Anyway, but you know, I said, you know, and there's that one way to go where you just keep like staying on that train. And I started like probably around season 9, I just started cutting back episodes because just didn't want to. I wanted that time off, so I mm-hmm. would negotiate for 18 out of 22 or 3 or whatever,
right?
Because I just wanted my time was more important to mm-hmm. me, and so. Yeah, I mean, everybody approaches all that stuff so differently, and you know, and I obviously still really cared about the show, and I cared yeah. about the people I worked with. That was the hardest part, was just knowing that it was coming to an end, and I was not going to be spending every day with these people who were amazing. It was an amazing crew,
yeah.
an amazing group of actors, and but I couldn't do it anymore. I just felt it was becoming a part of my identity or something.
You're waking up in the wanting to solve crimes.
Well, or, you know, everywhere you, because it was such a global hit, you know,
yeah.
it just was.
Did anyone ever ask you
Kathleen, for, you know, you just stopped everywhere.
Like, yes. No, I could imagine.
Yeah.
And especially people that are in forensics, were they fans of the show?
Some were. I mean,
you know, real criminologists.
Yes. Yes. I mean, they certainly liked the attention that the show brought to their field, you know,
yeah.
because prior to CSI, it was, you never really saw criminalists. They were just kind of like the nerds wore like, you know, CSI on their back or whatever.
Right.
It was always the detectives or even like the coroners even got more attention than the criminalists. So
yeah.
I think that's, they really like that. And they also love the fact that, you know, because the show was so popular, we got all of that state of the art equipment and, which a lot of the labs never could afford. So mm-hmm. I think they, you know, we'd many times bring attention to that and like, you know, provide the funds so these various labs could get these,
wow.
this kind of equipment. Yeah.
I want to ask you about working with I want to ask you too before I move off of CSI about working with Jerry Bruckheimer, like somebody who is just, I don't know, a mainstay in the, he seems to, you don't know, you don't all, I mean, I grew up and it was always like Simpson Bruckheimer.
Mm-hmm.
You just saw them on movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, when I was like a little intern working for Peggy Siegel, we wouldn't even dare to go near him. We did Beverly Hills Cop 2 and things like that. So we would see him around. But
did he produce the first one too, Beverly?
He did Simpson Bruckheimer.
Yeah.
God, we were so. And there were crazy stories about Don Simpson. Just like, again, the whole reason I got into show business,
right?
Was like,
yes,
just hearing stories. But he was silent. He was like the quiet. I've never
Jerry.
Yes.
Oh,
I've never heard him speak.
I know.
Is
well,
he funny?
The first time I met him was because I did.
Did you audition?
I did Bad Boys.
Oh, okay.
And Don was still around,
yeah.
and Don was actually very friendly, and
yeah.
you know, he was the gregarious one of the two, and Jerry just very seldom. Like, I mean, I wasn't on that movie very many days, but
yeah.
you know, he was really quiet. But then when he got involved with CSI, same thing, you know. But you know, he's a great guy. He's a great producer. He came to like. I think he came to, if he was in town, he came to every rap party. He came to like the Christmas parties,
yeah.
you know, just to say thanks for the hard work you all are doing. And it made a lot to the crew,
yeah.
know, that he would show up and do that. He would visit the set, you know, less so as the seasons rolled on. But I guess his input, main input would probably be the style of the show. I mean,
his aesthetic.
His aesthetic, yeah. Like
okay.
especially when the show became, you know, like kind of an instant hit. You know,
right.
He had to, you know, we got the good DPs and we got like the good costume designers and we got, you know, all those people.
The look,
the style. And he maintained it for all those years. And
yeah, that was another thing. The look, your look on the show has not changed. Like if you audition, you always have to wear. That became like the look for a police.
Oh yeah, yes, like leather jackets and
jeans,
jeans, boots.
So it's like sort of sexy but tough, but not too sexy. It's you know,
yeah.
It always became the.
Yeah, it still is, right?
It never is. It's funny when something gets established. Another movie I want to ask you about is The Cowboy Way.
Yeah.
They were shooting that. Like, what did you say? That? Yeah.
Oh, no. I mean, no, I had a good time on that movie.
You shot it in New York City.
Yeah.
A friend of mine had a part in that. I think that was in the 90s, early 90s.
Yeah. I want to say about 93 or 4, something like that. Yeah.
And
who was your friend?
Oh God, you're killing me, Mom.
Sorry.
You're killing me.
We probably didn't have any scenes.
Italian girl. She's a young Italian girl. And I remember that she was terrified. She got cast in the movie, but they told her she had to lose 10 pounds.
Oh my God.
And she was desperately trying to lose weight. I don't know why I suddenly can't think of her name. And then later on, she was on The Sopranos. Very pretty Italian girl. I can't think of her name. But she has a very small part in the movie. But she loved working in the movie, except for the pressure to lose weight.
And for a small part, they still made her lose 10 pounds?
Yeah, they said she was fat. They called her fat. She was fat.
I'm sorry to hear that.
She was like, "Do you think I'm fat?" And I was like, "No." She was like, "They want me to lose 10 pounds. I'm trying so hard."
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I had a small part on that thing too, but the one scene, there was this big scene, you know, my character owned a modeling agency and we had a big party in which models came and, you know, lots of flamboyant, you know, gay guys and that scene was really fun, because I got to do this dance with Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
But the day that I was supposed to do that dance, I was put up in the Parker Meridian Hotel, and they were known to have this massive gym, you know, gymnasium inside on the bottom level or whatever. And I was, you know, like lifting like a 35-pound plate to put on this like leg lift thingy, and it slipped out of my hands and fell onto my toe, and I knew I broke my toe, and I went to the medic, and it was, you know, it was purple, and he goes, "Yeah, that's broken, all right." And I was to do that dance sequence, and
unbelievable.
So I, you know, I just grinned. They taped him because there's nothing you can really do.
Yeah.
They just taped my toes together, and I put on those spike heeled shoes, and Woody was wearing those shit kicker, you know, boots, it was fine. It was fine. I was a lot younger then too. Like these days, I don't know what I would have done if that had happened now, but he was fun. He was a lot of fun, Woody.
I love him. Did you see? Have you seen Three Billboards?
Yeah, he's great in that.
So good in that movie.
Yeah.
I'm like,
he's great in everything.
He's great in everything, but like lately, it's like, oh my God, like Fine Wine. He's just becoming
he's in every movie too.
That's true. Stop being in every movie. What about Mr. Brooks, Kevin Costner? I love Kevin Costner.
Oh my God, I do too.
I only did a small part with him, but he's charming and he loves movies.
Yes.
Did you talk about movies at all?
A little bit, yeah. But yeah,
he's so cool. He's Mr. Americana. Cool.
I know. And so sexy.
Yeah, very. Yeah, well, I wouldn't know about that. I was always like stumbling and mumbling when I was around.
Which film did you do with him?
It was called Message in a Bottle.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I would just like be dope, you know. He'd like try to talk to me like a normal person. I'd be like, "So I read that you liked Liberty Valance." I would just talk about movies. He'd be like, "How do you know that?" Or I knew that he was an extra in Francis. His jaw dropped. He goes, "How do you know that?" And I was like, "Because I love the movie and it was, you got famous," and then I was watching the movie. I'm like, wait a minute, Kevin.
Oh, you spotted him?
Yes, I spotted him.
Oh, wow.
He told me not to tell anyone.
Words out.
That was a kind of a movie I love, Mr. Brooks. Like a kind of a, what would you call that? That's in that, you know, Dial M for Murder sort of stylish.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's sort of like, in broad terms, is it thriller, I guess? I don't even know. I mean, psycho thriller.
Stylish thriller.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and, that, charade.
Yes, that the two of them were both great in that, Wayne Hart and Kevin. And I wasn't on that. I was on that maybe on and off for 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah.
Because I was still shooting CSI. I was finishing up the season on CSI. They shot that in Shreveport, if you can believe that. It's supposed to be like Portland or something like that.
I remember that year. It's like with movies. Every year, like, oh, yeah, the year that...
They were in Shreveport.
The year they were in Wilmington or Toronto or Quebec, Michigan.
Now it's Atlanta. Like, everything seems to be in Atlanta.
Yeah. It was New Orleans. Or New Mexico. Everything's
Of course.
Everything seems to be in New Mexico. I'm like, I don't want to go to New Mexico. What about working on Always with Steven Spielberg?
Oh, God, that was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was great in so many ways. It was Moses Lake, Washington, and which is,
outside of Spokane.
Yeah, I guess. Yes. Yeah. And there was all these coolies, you know, like. Which is and there was a big airplane hangar there. There were so many good stories from that movie. One in particular I remember because the script was a few people had tackled that script. And it was based on that old film.
Guy Called Joe.
Something. Yes, with Spencer Tracy. Mm-hmm. And so Tom Stoppard had been one of the writers on this movie, and I remember in Steven's films, at least. That was the case for me. If whether you worked or not, you were like in costume, and I played like kind of this grease monkey character, and I had this vehicle that was this thing called a sign on that called Follow Me that would planes would I'd guide planes onto the runway or whatever. And I remember I was hanging out in an empty hangar waiting just because there was nothing. I didn't want to hang out in the tiny little honey wagon, and I had my feet propped up and I was reading the book, and here comes this guy who's like kind of like handsome and debonair. It turns out it was Tom Stoppard, and they had flown him in to do some script changes, and I was like, and I knew who he was. I was kind of like a little bit tongue-tied, and he like pulled out a pack of cigarettes, and I go, oh, could I have one? And he said, oh, of course. I didn't know that, cause most people don't smoke anymore. So please have that. And then we just chatted a little bit about the character. And, and I just felt like, oh, my God, here I am. In addition to being Steven Spielberg. So, it was just the coolest guy. He's so sweet.
Yeah.
And
that seems like it was I worked with Frank Marshall, and I know everything is just like A-plus all the way, I would imagine.
Yeah, like on the – because we were working 6 days a week, and – the day off, they really planned like fun stuff.
That's
like,
what they do.
Yeah, it was because we were near this lake, Moses Lake, and they rented all these like jet skis and power boats, and it just was. That's how we spent our days off, was doing that fun kind
movies
of stuff.
We didn't do that, but like Frank would do his magic act and stuff like that, or we'd have.
I heard you talk about this on your podcast when you're talking about that movie, Alive.
Alive, and we had a talent show, and they rented Frank. They'd make us do songs and stuff.
Well, now
they rented a movie theater.
What year was that? Did you shot
that? Is I think 94. I think it's either 93 or 94.
Always was, I think, 89 when they still had people would show up for rushes.
Totally. And they would do a gag. Frank spent as much time doing a gag reel as we did on the movie.
Oh, yeah, they encourage you to like improvise and goof off, so just for specifically for the gag or for rushes, just for people who would show up for the rushes
and have a big party.
Yeah. There was always popcorn at the rushes. You could bring beer and, they made it really fun.
Did you like Richard Dreyfuss?
Yeah. I mean,
I
remember
a good part for him.
Yes, it was. Yeah. He actually wanted to give me some direction with one of the scenes,
Oh God. Tell me about it. I met him I was obsessed with him when I was a kid, but I played his wife in a movie. I was terribly, terribly miscast. The movie was Mayor Lansky.
Uh-huh.
And I got cast, and they put this old age makeup on me, and I'm supposed to be 50. And again, like, I always look at this picture, like I take this Polaroid, I'm like, this is what they told me I was going to look like at 50. And of course, I don't, you know, I look like I'm 80. You know, it looks like the kind of makeup you do in high school.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like I may as well have a cane. Yeah. Yeah. He immediately gave me direction and I did whatever he told me to do. And then I started laughing and I got yelled at because he was directing me like Richard Dreyfuss in The Goodbye Girl.
How was, who was the director on that?
John McNaughton.
Okay.
And
so did he, was he was cool with like Richard giving you direction?
No, or? Of course yeah. not. It was like a comedy of, I first of all, I didn't want to do the movie because I said I cannot do a Jewish accent. I'm Italian. I know everybody thinks I'm Jewish. I cannot. I sound like Barbra Streisand. I worked on the accent, cut to doing the movie, take one. He goes, Ileana, you sound like Barbra Streisand. I was like, I was going to make pot roast. I make a terrific pot roast. And he was like, this is not, this is terrible. So then I'm acting with Richard Dreyfuss, and all I could think of is The Goodbye Girl. And he was telling me, he's like, when I open the drawer, I want you to cry. And then when I close the door, like he was literally step by step telling me what to do. And then
Richard was doing it.
Richard was doing this. And then John McNaughton pulled me aside and was like, what are you doing? This is all wrong. Like, why are you doing this weird thing? Oh, and I was like, well,
so
Richard
I guess
wants
his thing. He likes to.
Yeah. So direct it. I was getting conflicting directing.
Yeah.
And it just all seemed funny to me. And I, oh, here's a good question. I hate to admit this, but I, you know, I was such a serious actor, but they were shooting it and I was like, well, it's happening. I'm just going to fake it. And I just like, I couldn't do what either John or Dreyfuss wanted me to do. So I just literally like covered my eyes and pretended I was crying. It was like the worst. Have you ever like faked it or just like, oh, well, they're shooting it. I'm just going to do the best I can.
Well, I mean, you know, certainly I've had those instances where you're, you know, you're great in the rehearsal and or you're great at home. And then, yeah. You know, for whatever reason, the tears just aren't coming. Because God knows you hate to, like, push it, right?
Yeah.
You know, I guess the best thing to do, like, at least for me, that was just to just don't push it. I mean, if they come, they come. If they don't, they don't, you know?
But sometimes you don't have the luxury. When I did a live, again, this speaks to Frank Marshall, who's amazing. We were trying to do something, and it was so important to me. They tried to jam it in. You know, it was one of those things they weren't expecting to do it, and suddenly they came to me. Can you try to do it?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And I was too distracted. People were loading equipment, and they're shutting, and I said, I'm begging you, please. Like, I can't do it. I don't. We did like one or two takes, and for at a great expense, he said, "Oh, okay, all right, we're not going to do it." And he gave me that opportunity.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah, which rarely happens to reboot, and you know, we did it either the next day or something, and it was like amazing, and I really appreciate it. But yeah. Like I said, on this Meyer Lansky thing, I did not have the opportunity. It was like I just, you know. So sometimes you're just bad and you have to accept it. But obviously it's never. And that's my motto.
I get more uptight about stuff like it being frightened, you know, like making that real, you know.
Oh, that's terrible. Have you ever had to do the one? The other one that's horrifying is a phone call and getting bad news. And the camera like goes in on you real close. That was a hard one for me.
Oh, well, the soap. Yeah,
yeah.
For sure. You had to do that stuff all the time. But I think I'm more frightened of not having, you know, the emotion for, you know, the tears. It's just being frightened and making that believable, you know, because I don't know. I always think I'm faking it. And
yeah. Was there anything you ever – I turned down a movie because I can't – again, sounds crazy. I do not want to work in water. That's just a thing for me. I don't want to be soaking in water. I just couldn't do it. And I couldn't understand.
Was it the whole thing in water?
No, it was a big section of it being on a boat. And I said, first of all, I get seasick. I'm just telling, they're like, oh, it's only, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm being honest with you. We're going to all be out in a boat. And I just don't think I can do it.
Yeah.
So do you have any physical or are you afraid of, you know, rats or?
No, I remember when we were shooting the movie Species. There was
Species.
There was a section of the film where, you know, it's towards the end of the film, and we like, you know, it's it, that cast was, you know, extraordinary. Ben Kingsley and Alfred Molina and Forest Whitaker and Michael Madsen. And here we are chasing the species thing who's like a supermodel, you know, that's like turns into this creature. There's a lot of goofy things about it, but it was so much fun. Anyway, towards the end of the film, she's like really gotten away. And,
yeah.
And you know, we go through this whole sewer sequence. And I think Ben's character gets killed off in that sequence. Anyway, and then it's just Forrest, Michael, and myself, and we're in a cave. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, my character slips and falls into a pool of like tar. And it was Warner Hollywood. We were shooting on those stages. We like took over two stages, and it wasn't actually tar, but it was some sort of, I don't know, thick, goopy water that was I would be in it for seemed hours on end, and to the point where my toes had gotten completely frozen. You know, they were, and I took my shoes off, and I said, could I get a break here? You know, I showed Roger Donaldson, who's a lovely guy, who's directing that film, and they were like, oh, Mog, oh, hello. He was like shocked when he saw my feet. They were like, I don't know, yellow, purple. They were all these like extraordinary colors. So, and then they gave me a break, and then, you know, I got back in. He said, well, I'll make it quick. I'll make it quick. And, you know, I did survive that. But, you know, they kind of forget that you're kind of in there because he's got a lot on his mind, and I get it. But, you know, you have to speak up.
Yeah, they completely forget. And I couldn't let the hour go by without talking about Larry Sanders. We're both on the Larry Sanders show.
Oh, my God, how sweet was he?
The best. I learned so much about, you know, comedy and pathos, and it was just a great experience. Wasn't that a fun show to be on?
Oh, completely.
And be kind of yourself, but like making fun of yourself.
And every time I would see him, you know, wherever it was, an award show or something, he couldn't have been lovelier. I mean, he was just the sweetest guy, and always like said something funny, and
I know.
And it was just heartbreaking when was that last year or 2 years ago that he
died? I feel like it was two years ago, but it's just, I miss him so much. Just that sensibility.
Did you become friends with him?
Little bit, and then, you know, over the years, then he seemed to isolate himself.
Yeah.
And when I was writing the book, I contacted him and said, you know, you're in the book and I want to make sure you like it. And I made a point to see him, and then he died, you know. So it was like shocking because I really felt like
it was really shocking.
I felt like he was going to have a really important kind of third act kind of.
I did too. I thought for sure there was going to be another HBO show or Netflix or something.
Absolutely.
Because he was so gifted.
Yeah. And you were doing theater in New York.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How long? You were there for a long time, right?
Well, I mean, this play I did was actually it was an off-Broadway play. It was all in. It was short. It was only like 3 months. But I've done like three plays in the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. This was a Teresa Rebeck play, and she's this black comedy about gender politics in the workplace, which was like interesting time to be doing a play like about that. But then the year before that, I did a production of Little Foxes. I don't know if you're familiar with that play, this Lillian Hellman play.
Yes.
Which that's like one of those iconic roles, Regina Gibbons. And, you know, that kind of took its toll on me, that because she's such a, you know, manipulative. I mean, fun character, but also just like cruel and manipulative, and the use of the N-word. And we did it in Washington D.C. at the Arena stage, and we finished, you know, like a week before the election. And I'm so glad I got out of D.C. before that, because it would be so hard to play a really, you know, I would find it very difficult to play a really tough character like that, given how depressing the outcome of the election was. I mean, everybody, it was like a death, right?
Oh,
well, not
completely.
For everybody, obviously, but
for me, it was, I still haven't recovered.
I know.
The Arena stage is a great stage. I have been there. I worked at the Ford's Theater many years ago.
It's such a theater town, Washington. I had no idea.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. And all the, you know, there's some interesting places to go around there, too, for museums, of course.
Oh, yeah. That was it's a fun city. I love D.C.
I loved it, too. But like you said, the the day the music died. I don't know if I'd want to go there now. That in New York. New York is kind of no fun either, you know. We're in these feudal times or something.
Yeah.
Robber barons. That's right. What it seems like to me. Kind of robber barons. Like we're going back to the turn of the century, you know, with all the big rich people and everybody else fighting in the streets or something, you know.
Yeah.
So what are you doing now? Are you going to do more theater or what are your plans?
I wish I could tell you.
Take some time
I am going back to New York Saturday, actually, this Saturday, because I still have an apartment there. I leased it through March. And you know, I'm going back for a couple of meetings. You know, this I was telling about this producer earlier who wanted to do his production at the Balcony, although I don't know if that's going to happen because it's a tough play. It's really, mm-hmm. you know, I'm surprised. It's because it's still pretty avant-garde, and this producer is pretty commercial. But, you know, I don't know. I just, I'm hoping, you know, it's something will come along. I don't have anything lined up.
Oh, well, on that note, no, I'm kidding. On that note, Marg, I'm so glad that you came by. Thank you. Please come back anytime.
No, thanks. I'd love to.
Great.
Talk about
you.
Movies. When you're, do you have like movies that when you get into bed and eat popcorn, like do you have any go-to movies that you like to see?
Well, those movies that, you know, when you're channel surfing and you, it's on and you're like, oh my God,
yes.
Right? I mean, there's a few, obviously All About Eve.
The best.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Oh,
great.
Fatal Attraction. I remember I was late to something because I couldn't stop watching that one.
Yeah.
What's Love Got to Do with It? You know, the Tina Turner.
Yeah.
That's happened to me
biopics.
A few times. I do too.
I'm a suck.
Walk Hard. The Dewey Cox story.
Yeah. No, I'm a sucker for biopics.
Any of the Godfathers, of course.
Well, it's because it's like coming home.
Yeah, too. Exactly.
even the third one? Even the third Godfather?
No, not the third one. Say. Not the third one.
Yeah,
although I didn't hate it as much as, I mean, I remember seeing that.
Yeah.
And there were some women behind us that started howling with laughter when Sofia Coppola's, when she got killed. And
yeah.
Really? Is it that? They obviously thought it was the whole thing was just terrible, but
yeah,
which I didn't. I did not think that. And I thought she was actually kind of lovely in it.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't be arrested to the tube if that one came along. Tube. I still call it the tube.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Oh my the
God.
Tube.
We're not going to judge you
tube.
On that.
Thank
no
you.
Way. Mark, do you want to talk a little bit about Almost Friends? On iTunes.
Oh, yes. I did this little indie movie with Freddie Highmore. It was actually a really lovely cast. Freddie Highmore was in it, and Odea Rush, and Christopher Maloney, who's hysterical.
Oh.
And he played my ex-husband in the film. And it's a, you know, kind of a coming of age millennial story, you know, mm-hmm. and I could relate to it to a certain degree because, you know, my son was trying to find his way and now he's, you know, going to law school. But that's who's Freddie. And talk about a lovely young guy. God, mm-hmm. he's incredible. So that came out in November and then it's now you can get, you know, video on demand on iTunes and.
There's so many. Do you have Warner Archive at all? I have so many. Warner Archive has.
Well, you do a lot of TCM stuff for them, don't you? Or
but as I was looking through Warner Archive, I was like, oh, a movie with Mark Helgeberger from the 70s was like a TV. It was really interesting.
From the 70s
or 80s. It was very early.
Yeah,
because
I wasn't still in college. I got out of college in 82.
I'm gonna put
a TV movie.
I put it on my queue. I put it in my queue. I'll email
you. I did a lot
you.
Of those in the 90s. There was a lot of
those.
You
know, but that's
TV
when TV movies,
movies
were really good.
I know. I did. Yes.
So I'll let you know what it was because I clicked on it last night. I was going to watch it, but then I got sucked into a biopic.
Which one?
Rebel in the Rye about J.D.
Salinger. Oh, that's new, isn't it?
Yeah. I love biopics. I got sucked in.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
So I'm sorry, Mark. I really should have. I was like, I had it cute. I was like, I'd be really good if I watched this movie and surprised her. But
I wonder what it was. With these friends I was with last night.
I put it on my queue.
Okay. Yeah, we talked about that last night too. This because my one of my friends is like he loves all those movies. You know, like his favorite one is the one that did. Of course, now that's happening to me. I can't remember her name. The actress that was on Family Ties. She was the mom.
Justine Bateman.
No, the mom.
Meredith.
Joanna.
Meredith Bernie. Yeah, that's right. She did one that was like the Betty something story, which, and it was.
Yes.
that's like his favorite, one of his favorite movies of all time, whether it's TV or, you know, big screen. And we talked about that era, and I did a ton of them in the 90s.
I watched all of those, growing up. There was one with Vanessa Redgrave where she played the transgender. Tennis player.
Yes, Renee Richards. Yeah, right?
That was a crazy one.
There was really good ones. You know, Ted Danson played like a real, you know, sociopath. And there was the one about Ted Bundy, which Mark Harmon actually played.
Yeah. I remember that in high school. That was terrifying.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's like.
Well, I know you want to wrap it up here, but there was one that Quentin Tarantino directed an episode of CSI, finale.
Oh, I can't believe I didn't ask you
and
that.
And the story was based on this story that was a TV movie when I was a teenager, when he was a teenager too. It was about this girl that was buried alive and had how to keep her alive. And that's how the story is. And I said, did you? And he goes, yes, that was the TV movie that he had seen, too. Yeah,
well, he was in the videos, and I'm sure he liked. He's such a movie file.
Oh God,
Quentin.
Oh yeah,
that must
have
been really
obscure, and because he had cast a bunch of actors that had done a lot of television.
Yeah,
because he was a huge fan of, you know, TV too.
Yeah,
so yeah, he was, and he's so sweet.
That's such a great sweet guy. TV is so, you know, interesting right now that there aren't that you could. I love the idea of having Quentin Tarantino or anybody, Michael Bay, come in and...
Billy Friedkin directed two episodes of our show. And he's sort of the Billy Peterson connection. And he was charming as hell and...
I love him.
Fun.
His films. He comes on TCM and another... All these great people.
Oh, yeah,
all right. Well, what I learned today,
Mark,
is that somehow I need to get to Jack Nicholson. I'm a very good cook. I'll bring food.
You can find Marg on Twitter at Marg Helgen and also at Marg Helgenberger on Instagram. Thank you, Marg, for being with us. Also,
you can find
Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, on Amazon and in bookstores. Also, like our Facebook page, and the website is ileanaspodcast.com.
That's right. And as I like to say, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is the end of our podcast. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Marg.
Thanks, Ileana.
Thanks, Tamara.
Thank you.
Thanks, okay, Tamara. Have a great
See
day.
Next time.
Bye.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.